Hello and welcome to the Arsenal Beat. My name is Sam Dean. I'm a football reporter at the Daily Telegraph and Sunday Telegraph. You've probably heard from me before if you've heard this podcast, and you've probably heard from Charles Watts, who's also on the show today. Hi, Charles. How are you?
I'm very good, Sam. Hope you're well, mate.
Yeah, all good. And we are joined today by a debutant on the Arsenal Beat. It's none other than The Guardian's Nick Ames. Nick, hello. Welcome. How are you doing?
I'm feeling my pressure, Sam, but otherwise I'm very good. How are you?
All good, all good. Now, Nick, because it's your first appearance on the show, it's now your chance to sell yourself as a journalist and tell us who you are, how long you've worked at The Guardian, and all the things that we should know about you before we hear your views.
Keeping it simple, I work for The Guardian. I largely cover Arsenal. Been doing this particular beat for about the last 18 months or so, and I've worked at The Guardian overall for about 6 years, mainly on football. Previous to that, and we're going back quite a few years now, I did work at Arsenal Football Club for a while, I'm doing features and other things on the programme and matchday and monthly magazine and stuff like that. So my involvement with Arsenal goes back to about 2007, with a gap in the middle, I would say.
Am I right in thinking that at that time when you were working at the club, Mikel Arteta was one of the players and someone you dealt with quite regularly?
Yes, he was. He was towards the end of my time there. And then I came back later and did some freelance stuff for them. So I used to interview Mikel quite a lot. My favourite one was big interview he gave when he gave his blueprint for management that I think kind of circulated a little bit this time last year. It was a joy. He was, you know, a bit like we all know now. He's very, you know, he doesn't dodge a question much. He's very personable, gives full answers, and very bright. So no, I used to love sitting down with him, and I was very happy when he got the job last year.
So is he the same Mikel now, you think, as the Mikel you knew or spoke to regularly back then?
I think his cards are a bit closer to his chest, honestly. I think he is good in press conferences and media and the other little interactions that we have with him here and there, but there is that certain distance. I think as a player, he was probably a little bit more forthright and open about his approach and his vision and his plans and that kind of thing, and on other subjects too, perhaps. I think it's sort of, I mean, we probably shouldn't say this as journalists, but probably almost necessary in today's environment that you take a job like that and become manager as he is now and kind of have a more statesman-like approach and maybe a slightly more cautious approach in your proclamations. But to be honest, he was always very statesman-like anyway, to be honest. You always sat down with him and you had that gravitas, you know, that kind of feeling that, okay, this guy's not just a footballer saying words. And a lot of footballers do just sit there and say words, as we all know. He wasn't just doing that. And I think that was a big difference.
Charles, you were there last night, so was I, for the Southampton draw, 1-1. I guess, firstly, what did you make of the game? And secondly, I think the wider issue to discuss today, at least in the first section, is this problem with red cards, because I think that's seven now since Mikel took over. On his first game was on Boxing Day last year, of course, and that's four more than any other Premier League team in that time. So evidently, there's an issue there. I wondered what you made of that and the performance yesterday.
Yeah, there's certainly an issue there. In terms of the game, I thought the first half was pretty poor, sort of continuing the theme of what we've seen recently. Got a little bit better towards the end of the first half, I thought, the final 10 minutes or so, and they carried that into the second half, and I thought they started well, got themselves back level, and you kind of felt at that point they were going to go on and win it, just as you thought against Burnley they were going to go on and win it after they came out well in the second half. And same old story, isn't it? Red card changes the game, and at least they showed quite a bit of fight. I was surprised against Burnley at how badly they played after they went down to 10 men. It really sort of rocked them, and I didn't think it kind of would against a team like Burnley. I thought they still had enough to potentially go on and win that, but they went into their shell a little bit. But they fought for everything in the final half hour yesterday, and I thought that was at least something to hold on to. I thought Rob Holding did really well. He's certainly won a lot of balls into the box when he needed to. Luiz, I thought, made an impact when he came on. He sort of talked everyone through everything during that final half an hour. It was really noticeable. Leno did what he had to do when the balls came into the box. So they certainly showed a lot of spirit, which was good, because given the run of form they're on, they could have easily folded against a decent Southampton side. You know, they're a good side, Southampton, this season. So there was certainly some positives to take, but ultimately it's another game they haven't won, and another game at home they haven't won, and you know, they need to start winning. They just need to start somehow getting results, and it's just frustrating. Like you said, the red cards, the lack of discipline that they're showing now, is costing them dearly. I think all three of those games, Leeds, Burnley, and last night, you know, you could have easily walked away with those with 9 points. They're in position to possibly walk away with those games with 9 points, and ended up just getting two because they had to play for so long with 10 men. And you just can't do that in Premier League. I mean, Mikel said it afterwards. Everyone knows it. You can't do it. And they're shooting themselves in the foot. And it's something that he has to sort out himself, because ultimately it's going to end up costing him his job otherwise.
He was asked about this in his press conference earlier this week about the discipline issues. And he sort of made the point that you can't really compare Xhaka's red card and Pepe's red card with some of the others, which were sort of on-pitch tackles gone wrong or last-ditch challenges. And is that a fair point, do you think? Or should we group it all together and say 7 red cards as one is just far, far too many? Or can we say, yes, OK, when Luiz got one against Chelsea, he was preventing a goal? Or when, you know, Gabriel got it yesterday because he knew Walcott was turning? What do we put that down to? And is it fair to say, you know, they've just got hot heads? Is he firing them up too much?
I think you can put all of it down to poor game management and decision-making at key points. I think, yes, there are different types of red card, as you and indeed Mikel have just outlined. But it all comes down to, I think, a fundamental lack of understanding about sometimes what is a desperate situation in a game and what isn't. When am I in danger? When do I have to make this foul? When don't I? When do I go and wade in and into this fracas, and when don't I? How much do I have to be showing that my heart is on my sleeve, and when is that not so appropriate? And I think, and maybe that is a generalisation, but I think there is in this squad, and there really shouldn't be, because a lot of them have been around for a long, long time, and, you know, been through this before. We can look at Granit Xhaka, for example. I think there is still this maddening naivety and inability quite to get a read on a situation. When do I back off? When do I play it cool? Like I've just said, basically. And I think that runs throughout the team, but I'd be interested in whether you guys agree on that.
I think I do agree. I think the Xhaka one was most infuriating. I mean, Pepe's was stupid. He got sucked in. But Xhaka, given his history, given, you know, senior pro, former captain, to be sucked in like the way he was against Burnley at the time when Arsenal were so on top and looking like they were going to get what was going to be a really, really crucial win, to do that, I thought was so, so poor of him. And he really, really let the team down there, especially because it came a couple of games after what happened with Pepe as well. So that must have been in his mind. And you could see what was happening before it even happened. And it was just such a ridiculous thing to do. Yesterday, Gabriel kind of lost his head for the whole game, really. I thought it was poor. It was just, I mean, he's been very good this season, but it was not performance from the start. He got sucked in too much. He was almost trying to play on the front foot too much. I don't know if that was trying to get the team going, but he was jumping into challenges. He was misreading things. He got caught out for the goal, got caught out for the red card when Theo turned him. And again, I mean, it's not really the same situation as Granit or as Nico, but it was still a stupid thing to do considering being booked 4 minutes before for kicking the ball away. It's just like, keep your head. You're in a good position here. Just don't lose your head. And he did. It was really, really poor. And yeah, Mikel must be tearing his hair out, that beautiful hair as well.
Earlier this week, a couple of journalists had the chance to speak to Edu. And for those who aren't aware of how this worked, for reasons of sort of logistic simplicity, Edu spoke to a couple of newspaper journalists and it was shared around among the rest of them rather than being handpicked for one or two papers, which is quite common in the Zoom world for that to work that way. Nick, you were fortunate enough to be on that call with Edu, a good 35 minutes, I think, with the main man. What did you make of him? I don't know if you dealt with him before. I think you were on a call with us. We were all on that call, I think, before in the summer when we spoke to Edu and Vinay. What did you make of what he had to say? And you know, how important is this January window or difficult, actually, maybe is the better question, how difficult will it be for him and someone in his position of power?
I mean, firstly, it was good to have that kind of access and time with Edu. That's not always an approach that Arsenal have taken in recent years. So, you know, lifting the bonnet journalistically, that's great for us that we're able to have increasing amounts of time with executive team members. I think he was put himself on with a clear message to deliver that, you know, Mikel is going nowhere. Don't bother with that. They're giving him time, they're giving him support, and they want that stability. And I think that was the overriding theme that we kept coming back to in the 30 to 35 minutes. I thought he delivered that message fairly convincingly. That part of the message I don't disagree with at all. I think anyone talking about sacking Arteta or losing him is playing wrong at the moment. I don't think it's what the club needs. I don't think it benefits anyone. I think that was mainly the message he came on for. Eddie's very charming, quite smooth, chatty, smiley, quite gregarious, answers questions maybe without providing too much granular detail, I would say. But no, it was a convincing backing for Arteta, even if you could question some of the sub-points beneath it. For example, he was asked about Willian and was kind of like in the, well, give him time camp. And, you know, maybe we should give 6 months of a season to every 32-year-old who goes from one Premier League club to another. Maybe we've all been historically unfair in our expectations of footballers, but I, for one, think that given Willian was signed to be an older, more experienced head in a team that maybe had or has that naivety we've earlier mentioned, that was a little bit generous to his recent performances, if not his effort. One question that I did ask Edu was whether he felt under pressure as well, because obviously he was brought out, if you like, to bat for Arteta, but really, and I quite strongly think this, I think Edu is as up for scrutiny as anyone, in fact, probably more than anyone, in the coming weeks and months. He's got that level of oversight. He can see everything that's going on, as he told us many times in the call. You know, he can see everything at the training ground. It's all great. It's developing wonderfully. The next few years are going to be a beautiful future, that kind of thing, which we all hope that's what we'll be covering. But he's got to deliver now in the next couple of transfer windows. Did well to get Partey and Gabriel through the door and maybe take a bit of credit for that. And, you know, fair enough, they stumped the cash up. But as you've said already, they were recommended by or tracked for a long time by a scouting network that has since been hollowed out. So we don't know really what kind of deal is Eddie's able to do? What kind of deal is he's able to deliver over the next windows in order that Arteta can have the squad he wants? We don't know, for example, and I think this was obviously a big issue in the last window, whether Arsenal can ship the players out that they need to ship out, be that on loan, someone like Saliba, which didn't happen, should have happened, but didn't, be that senior players on big money who are still sitting around. And I think there's a lot to prove on the technical director side. Do you have the expertise and the personnel available and the decision-making qualities yourself to get that right? I didn't say all that to him, but I do think it. I think we're talking about Arteta a lot, but I think that in some of the decisions that were made during the summer by Edu and at the time Raul, I think a lot of what the club does in the next 6 months to a year will live or die on that.
It's interesting, Edu, because he is also really quite inexperienced in the sense that he's obviously worked with Brazil, had a good success there, and he had some time with Corinthians before that. But he's not had decades of experience doing this sort of thing either, and certainly not in Europe, which is a different market and a different kettle of fish to South America. Now, on the Gabriel deal, I mean, I was told in the summer that his sort of attempts to convince Gabriel to choose Arsenal were absolutely decisive, because there were lots of clubs in for Gabriel. And as we know, because it became a sort of 3 or 4 week saga at the time. And I think Edu really played a key part in that. And we've seen with other signings in contract extensions that Arteta's played a key role on that one. But from what I was told, that was really Edu's baby and one that he nurtured. So that's certainly one, whether he identified him or not, as he said in the first place, that's certainly one that he got through over the line and he should, I think, be praised for. But I agree with you that the scrutiny is going to be coming pretty quick, especially this winter. I mean, I personally can't see how they can sell or get rid of the players that they couldn't get rid of in the summer. Why would the likes of Ozil or Socrates leave now when they didn't leave then? This is just, they've only got a few months more to go sitting on that lovely money coming in. What's the point? And there'll be free agents in the summer. They can go where they want and get the financial benefits of that. So it's going to be a hard January, and it'll be hard for them to bring anyone in unless they can sell people, because that's just the reality of where they are with a squad so big. So yeah, this summer I think will be the key for Edu, but as ever in his position, people are going to be going mad about him and transfers and who they sign. And Charlie, do you think it's sort of the sort of situation now where ingoings and outgoings will determine the next season, next few seasons, or is it more to do with Mikel getting his tactics across to this group of players?
I think it's more about incomings. I mean, Mikel clearly needs to get his tactics across and get players playing the way he wants to play. But I think you look at that squad and you look at the mess of that squad and how mismatched it is at 8 centre-backs and, you know, no attacking midfielders in it. I mean, they need to sort it out. They need to bring in, if Saliba's not the man, then they're going to have to sort out potentially, I think, a long-term partner for Gabriel, because I'm not sure, despite them having 8 centre-backs there, I'm not sure any of them are that man. So that's something they're going to have to sort out. They've certainly got to sort out the attacking midfield area. You know, is it going to be Husamawa? Is it going to be... well, it's not going to be Szoboszlai because he's just gone to Leipzig. But, you know, they've got to fix that. And I think Edu was talking at a fans forum this week, didn't he? And he basically said it. He said, it's clear what we need. We need a player with creativity in the middle. We don't have that in the squad right now. Kind of do have that in the squad right now, but he's not in a Premier League squad. So they've got to solve that issue. And it's clear from watching Arsenal that is just, you know, they have to find a link between the midfield and the attack that can supply the forwards with some sort of chances. Because as we saw last night, if Aubameyang gets a decent chance on his feet in the penalty area, he's going to stick it away. You know, he's not someone who's going to head crosses into the top corner like... Firmino did for Liverpool last night, but you give him a chance in a penalty area like Eddie did, then he'll stick it away. He's not lost his form all of a sudden. So they've got to find more players who can cut teams open and deliver that. And you know, that's going to be crucial. And I think you've got to sort out the striker issue as well long-term, because it's not going to be Lacazette and they're going to have to get that man sorted at some point. So, you know, Mikel has to get his points across. He has to get his own players across. I think you look at that squad, you build it around Gabriel, Partey, Martinelli, Saka, you know, Auba. You know, but other than that, I think the next 2, 3, 4 windows that we're going to really see, you know, that's when they need to bring in players that fit Arteta's plans and we can really start to see his project, or Project Arteta, as we call it, start to take off.
Obviously, Everton this weekend is not an easy game. Everton have suddenly rediscovered their form as well. When you look at it and the run that Arsenal are on, what do you think, Charles? Is this the sort of another draw we'll do? Is it a point we'll be progress again?
I don't think so. I don't think you're not going to turn your nose up at a point at Goodison at the moment, given they've just beaten Chelsea and beaten Leicester away. But it's not going to help Mikel too much. I think he needs to get a win really, really quickly just to ease the pressure and get some people off his back. And so I'm sure he'll want to be going up there thinking about a victory and not a point. It's an interesting game, isn't it? The fact that it kind of marks the year of Mikel, the year of Ancelotti. Yeah, Ancelotti could have potentially been an option for Arsenal, but they went down a completely different route with the untried and untested Mikel. So I'm sure we're going to see lots of comparison pieces and things like that over the next couple of days coming up to it. You look back to that game at Everton, it was December the 21st last year, my birthday actually. And I remember it was such a bad game. So Freddie basically went up there and knew it was his last game and just thought, sod it, I'm going to make loads of changes. I'm going to dump Mesut, I'm going to play Emil Smith-Rowe, I'm going to play the youngsters, chuck them all in, make my big point. It was a dreadful game, awful 0-0. I just remember driving back home down the mountain thinking, what a way to spend my birthday. So hopefully this one's going to be slightly better, and it's 2 days before my birthday this year, so it's not going to be quite so bad, although it's a 5:30 game, which is a killer. But yeah, I mean, it's a massive game for Arsenal. They're all massive games at the moment. When you think they've got Man City on the Tuesday, I think, and then Chelsea on the Boxing Day, it's not going to get any easier over the next week, so they've got to find a win from somewhere, and it's going to be tough. But Everton have got Alan injured, I think, which could be a you know, that's a big loss for them. So Arsenal will, that's a little bit of a boost for Arsenal, but it's going to be difficult. And without Gabriel as well, who you thought would cope pretty well with Dominic Calvert-Lewin, he's good in the air. Gabriel, he likes getting up and clearing his headers away. So that is going to be a big miss. And again, it's a symbol of a lack of discipline costing Arsenal, not just in one game, but further games down the line.
Freddie's final game was brilliant, wasn't it? Absolutely joyful. How, I think it was the pre-match TV interview when he was asked about Ozil, and he said, he's not fit. But even if he was, I wouldn't be picking him, which is a completely sort of needless dig, but like absolutely glorious from a journalistic point of view. Because, you know, he knew he was gone. They'd already hired Mikel, and that was his final sort of passing shot, wasn't it? Although, since he's left the club and obviously done a few interviews in various places the last few weeks, he's been far more complimentary of Ozil than he was at the time as head coach, which I found quite interesting without knowing exactly why.
Absence makes for heart grow fonder, maybe, or distance. I was crunching some numbers before this podcast. Well, not quite numbers, but just looking at the likely teams for Saturday. And I think five of the likely starters for Everton would have started that game that we were just talking about, and five for Arsenal as well. So it's quite an opportune moment, really, to look at that amount of flux and the amount that those teams have changed. And I think it will tell us quite a bit, Saturday's game, really. I think Everton, on paper, good side, good place in the table, but they've got a defeat in them. They can be a bit leaky. I don't think they're anything to fear necessarily. If they click, they've got that fearsome strike force, but they can definitely quickly put a run of two or three defeats together. But I think Carlo's done a fantastic job with them. I remember covering them. I think they played Wolves away. I think it was just after football restarted, so June maybe. And it was one of the most negligent football performances I've seen from a Premier League team. They were 3-0 down at half-time. It could have been 8 or 9. Carlo said it afterwards. It was absolutely diabolical. You could just see the players wanted to not be there. And to go from that to this in 6 months, I think it's really impressive. And I think it's what Ancelotti's good at, isn't it? It's about marshalling what resources he does have and getting a tune out of them.
Let's briefly journey deep into a hypothetical parallel universe and say that Ancelotti took over at Arsenal this time last year. This is a guy who his reputation has basically been built. Well, extremely. This is not a criticism at all. It's one of his great accomplishments is managing the egos in a dressing room and making people feel comfortable. High-earning, powerful players tend to get on with him. Now, we know that Mikel has taken a different approach, Ozil being the obvious example, but there are others too where he's enforced discipline and he's been strict and he's demanded certain things culturally that most other managers wouldn't and other managers at Arsenal haven't. I wonder, how different do you think this Arsenal team would look now and this Arsenal squad would look now if Arsenal had gone for Ancelotti instead of Arteta? Almost the complete opposite. Do we think we'd have Ozil playing behind Aubameyang and Lacazette and sort of the old timers all still in place? Or, you know, would Saka be where he is? I know it's extremely hypothetical, but let's have some fun with it.
I think you've...
Go on, you go, Nick.
Yeah, I think he'd have probably thought, okay, Ozil's someone I can really maximise now that I've got him. I'm going to ring the best out of him. He'd have given him a good old run at number 10. It might have worked. I think with talking broadly with Ancelotti now, I think Arsenal would be higher up in the table. I do believe that, but I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing because I don't think there would be all the deep dive cultural work that is going on in the background and the club publicly and privately are setting great store in. And they're obviously trying to create a project that Mikel can oversee for the next goodness knows how many years. Whereas Ancelotti was sort of probably burned brightly for a couple of years and then you've got to do it all over again. So I think it'd be short-term gain, long-term questions.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think I was very against Ancelotti when it was kind of potentially being mooted. I thought Arsenal needed something a little bit different. I thought some of the guys behind the scenes at the training ground needed a stricter type of figure to come in and get them going again. I mean, they they ruled the roost against Emery, basically, didn't they? Turned on him and thought, I wasn't sure. And Wenger, certainly in his latter years, gave him a bit too much free will to do what they wanted. And I kind of felt they needed to go down a different route. And it's interesting when you look at, you talk about parallel universes, when you look at the end of the last season, and Nick talked about the Wolves game there, how poor Everton finished the season, how well Arsenal finished the season with a trophy. At that point, what, just 4 months ago, it would have been everyone said straight away, yeah, Arsenal made the right call and Everton haven't. And now it's just flipped on its head. And I do, although there's a lot of people, you know, questioning Mikel at the moment, I do think everyone has to take a little step back a little bit as well. It's a bad run. It's a horrible run. But I think losing Thomas Partey has been absolutely massive for Arsenal. It's just been, I mean, it's typical Arsenal. I mean, you sign a player who hasn't been injured 6 years and he gets injured straight away and spend all summer getting him, wait until deadline day, finally do it, and then, yeah, and he's crocked. And it's classic Arsenal, peak Arsenal.
Right, to finish off, we've had these hopefully quite fun and enjoyable little questions for everyone. Today's one, I want to ask you for your favourite player to watch at Arsenal over the years, whether that's in the last few seasons or going back a bit further.
This is a fan then, as well as a...
Can be as a fan. And what I'm not after your favourite player in terms of who you thought was the best player, but I mean the sort of player who you just took particular joy from watching, whether that's because of his style or the way he did things. Like, for example, my answer would be, I think probably peak Lucas Torreira in the first sort of 6 months of Emery's reign, when he came in and he was just like a dodging, like running around, just hitting people and just tackling people. And the crowd were loving it. I remember that, obviously, that famous win against Spurs. There was a moment down in the corner flag when he sort of tackled Christian Eriksen about three times in one move. Like he probably could have kept the ball after each one, but he sort of tackled him, lost it. And it was so different to what Arsenal had come used to. And I remember thinking that's just fun to watch and you could feel the energy around him. So, yeah, I mean, equally, you can just pick Thierry Henry because he was really good. But by all means, go a bit more left field if you wish. Nick, do you want to lead us off?
You are going to think I'm nuts, but I would choose it going from a time when I first became involved with Arsenal in 2007 and started covering them rather than watching on telly as a kid. Alexander Hleb. Alex Hleb.
Well, Charlie, I'm just going to cut you off there, Nick, because
I don't think he's having a speech to me again. Not, you know, Hleb in that 2007-08 season should probably have had 25 goals if only he bloody well shoot, you know. But just as someone maybe who, like, the team I support as a Championship side, for example, or no, it's not, they were in the Championship, they're now in League One. But as someone who maybe hadn't covered Premier League football before, like, to see the ball stick to his feet, and the movement of the hips and the balletic way you just couldn't get the ball off him. It was absolutely mesmerising. And I think probably if you're a fan especially, really frustrating because he never passed it at the right moment. He should have, you know, uncorked a few more shots. But just the way he moved with that ball, held people off, glided between people, was an absolute gift, even if I completely admit he didn't have the other part. Charlie, what's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with that. Hleb's a great player. I love Hleb. I love him. He frustrated the hell out of me at times when he did about four drag backs in a row and tried to beat a man four times rather than just laying the ball off. But he was brilliant. That team was fantastic to watch. They should have won the title, that team. They were brilliant. So now he's up there. For me, that's tough. Look, I was a fan I've been season ticket holder for 30 years. I've seen so many. And you know, I sat there and watched Dennis Bergkamp. And I can't answer this without saying Dennis Bergkamp just because he's the greatest player I've ever seen. He's a guy who embodies everything that I want when it comes to football and was just an absolute genius at everything. And, you know, I've seen Henri, seen Pires, who are just brilliant. In the modern era, Sanchez, just an animal. Cazorla, magician, who I loved watching. But Dennis Bergkamp is just, he's everything that football should be. When you open the dictionary and you see the word football, there should just be a picture of Dennis Bergkamp underneath.
Charlie, is your view of Alexander Hleb at all affected by the fact that he called you out as an idiot a few years ago after you photographed him in a Burger King at Borisov Airport?
He didn't call me an idiot. He said I lacked brains.
We've got about a minute and a half to tell this story about, but I don't think, Nick, you were on that trip, but certainly Charles and I were in the airport in Borisov, or was it Minsk Airport?
It was Minsk Airport, yeah, after Arsenal had just lost to Borisov the night before. And we were 7 in the morning, we hadn't slept, and Arsenal had just been beaten by a bunch of Belarusian farmers, as fans like to say. And then to top it all off, they sat down at the table, the entire squad next to us, and had a McDonald's breakfast. Well, it wasn't even a McDonald's breakfast. No, it wasn't. It was Burger King, wasn't it? It wasn't even a breakfast for Burger King. They were just eating double Whoppers at 6 in the morning, having just schooled Arsenal off the pitch. So I took a photo of it and tweeted it. And by the time I landed at Heathrow, it had about 10,000 shares. And it got right into the Belarus press. And Alexander Hleb said, "I lack brains." The journalist who took the picture lacked brains.
Was it because you hadn't abided to the rule of thirds and composed it properly?
It was. He did have his mouth wide open. It was quite unfortunate.
All right, lads, thank you so much for your time. I'm sure you'll both be back very soon, and as will Mark Manbryans, your usual host. So thanks, everyone. And as is customary, as we like to say, stay safe. Mm.